You're listening to another.
Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. Hard date to remember, September 11th, 2015, 14 years after the worst terrorist attacks ever carried out against our country in history. And that will primarily be my focus, my concern for this entire program. And it's dedicated to the decent people, the innocent victims of those terrorist attacks, to their families who will never be the same, their friends, their colleagues. Devastating attack, devastating consequences, not just for the United States, but for the world. And here we are 14 years later, and I have to tell you that my assessment of where we stand today, not because of political correctness. You know, if we don't identify the root cause of our problems, we're not going to solve them. We're not being threatened by politeness, which is what people who talk about political correctness are really saying, whether they know it or not. We are being threatened by one of the most corrupt bunch of politicians on all levels that this nation has ever been saddled with. We are dealing with idiots, with people with ego issues, with people who don't understand the facts, don't understand what the commitment that that oath of office is supposed to represent that they took when they were sworn in, having spent God knows how much money, thinking that spending money is an achievement. We have a nitwit member of the Senate who when was referred to as ma'am by an officer of the United States military took umbrage and said, "I worked hard to become a senator. How dare you call me ma'am?" My goodness gracious. This is the circus that runs our country today and all too often towns, cities, and states across this great nation of ours. And I hold we the people responsible and accountable. And it's not about left or right. It's about right or wrong. It's about the fact that we as citizens of this great republic have been asleep at the switch, and we had better wake up because things are headed south ever faster. And there's so much happening around the world, beginning with this supposed deal with Iran, people who have made it clear that their ultimate goal is our destruction, the destruction of Israel, the destruction of our way of life, of Western civilization, if it were, as it were. We're in a serious situation. And you have a president who's about to open the doors and allow in tens of thousands of basically unvetted individuals who come from countries that sponsor terrorism. What could possibly go wrong? That will be what we will look at today. Forgive me. My throat is kind of giving me hell. Too many appearances in the past few days, all because this is, again, the 14th anniversary of 9/11. Those of you familiar with my program know about the websites, but let's start out by talking about those just quickly. My own personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, one word, michaelcutler.net. For years, I have been affiliated and writing for a terrific bunch of folks out in Santa Barbara, California, Californians for Population Stabilization, capsweb.org, C-A-P-S is their website. I also write for Front Page Magazine. I am proud to be a columnist for that publication. It is the work of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, great bunch of folks. I also write for Progressives for Immigration Reform. This isn't a left-right issue, folks. This is a right-wrong issue. And the Social Contract has up a very important article that I wrote, an assessment on where we are 14 years after 9/11, looking at the immigration issue. It's a lengthy article. It's about 27 pages long. I was just on Chuck Wilder's radio program talking about it. I was with Ari was filling in for Jamie Glazov over at the Glazov Gang, again affiliated with the Horowitz Freedom Center. Yesterday, there should be a video up on the internet within the next few days. I taped a couple of TV appearances for today. Newsmax at 8 o'clock New York time, J.D. Hayworth's program. I'm on that show. I'm also with the Daily Ledger today over at One American News Network. You know, since 9/11, I have been adamant, absolutely determined to get the message out there that we are our own worst enemy, we, the United States of America. And I am a big fan, by the way, of political asylum. My grandmother, for whom I was named, was slaughtered in Poland during the Holocaust. Many of my mom's family suffered the similar fate because we are Jewish. I went to Washington when I was in high school and college to try to convince President Johnson, who occupied the Oval Office in those days, that he needed to get the Russians to permit Jews and other religious minorities to give them the right to leave Russia so they could come to America or any country that would have them, so they could experience liberty, religious freedom, get away from the tyranny of the Soviet Union. It was an exciting thing to do, and Dr. Martin Luther King sent Ralph Abernathy over to read a telegram. Our kids today may not know what a telegram is anymore, but those of you listening to my program probably certainly remember telegrams, where they would even be delivered to your homes. Unfortunately, all too often with bad news, sometimes with good news. But on that particular day, Ralph Abernathy came, read a telegram that was written by Martin Luther King, and eventually read a speech, rather. It was the president, it was Johnson, who actually sent us a telegram saying that he saw us from the Oval Office. We were visible to him because we were right outside the White House. He agreed with our position, and he promised his support. And when I became an immigration inspector and had the real privilege of admitting refugees into the United States, and they weren't only Jews. They were people of diverse religions. Of course, Jews were the greatest number because of the circumstances in Russia. But it was exciting to admit refugees into the United States. Relatively speaking, we were talking about a handful of people. They were carefully screened. There were no threats of terrorists coming to the United States among them. How the world has changed. And in fact, the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony, warned that refugee programs, political asylum programs, were dangerous because the countries that these people are fleeing from sponsor terrorism. There's no way to do a meaningful background investigation in those countries. So when you admit people virtually sight unseen, you don't know who they are, what their backgrounds are. I assure you that terrorists whose goal is to get their operatives into our country see in that chaos, and unfortunately see in our compassion, kindness, and rather in our compassion and kindness, opportunities and weakness. And we must never allow America's compassion and kindness to be turned as a weapon against our citizens. The primary objective of the government of the United States must be the survival of the United States and the lives of our citizens, irregardless of, you know, race, religion, ethnicity, doesn't matter. But we have an obligation as a country to our own citizens first and foremost. Of course, you would never hear it when you listen to those lying politicians, which is why, you know, all these pundits are scratching their heads. Why is Carly Fiorina and Donald Trump doing so well? Why is Dr. Ben Carson doing so well? We, the people, have had it with career liars, because that's what most politicians are. There are exceptions. We should not be tarring everybody with the same brush dipped in, not tar, but manure. I mean, there are people like Jeff Sessions, who's an amazing leader. I wish he was running for president. My good friend Lou Barletta, the congressman from Pennsylvania, does a great job trying to do the right thing for us. Chuck Grassley, the senator. I mean, there are a number of people. Senator David Vitter. There's a number, but it's a small number. The majority of the people that we have elected to office, all they care about is themselves. I don't even think they give a rat's tail about the future of their children or their grandchildren, because if they did, and if they were smart enough to fog a mirror with their breath, they would understand that the immigration issue, which is rewarding them financially, because this is all about the exploitation of labor, and not just people working at the scut-level jobs, but increasingly it's the high-tech workers also. I just wrote an article for Front Page Magazine about how we are educating our adversaries. We've never had more foreign students enrolled in our schools right now, and the great jump in the number of students studying the STEM programs are coming from Asia, from China, from India. And meanwhile, places like Disney, and I will never buy anything that has Disney attached to it. I wouldn't go to Disney World if they paid me to go. They just fired 500 American computer programmers. And these were not inept employees, because before they got rid of them, before they threw them out unceremoniously out the door, they said, well, if you want your severance package, you will train your replacement. If you think people are incompetent, you're not going to have them train anybody. You just want them to leave. They took 500 American families and threw them under the bus for a buck. So Disney will not get any of my bucks, and I recommend that we need to do our homework, and every time a company does it, we need to boycott them forever, forever, until they turn around and wake up that they are anti-American. Because when you fire American workers, you not only are hurting that family, which is despicable all by itself, that's enough to infuriate me, but you're destroying the American economy. And it's happening around the world now, because there's no greater consumer engine than the middle class of the United States, which no longer exists, pretty much. So you take the money out of the pockets of the people most likely to buy the dreck that you're peddling, the junk that you're peddling, who's going to buy it? You can't go out and buy an iPhone with belly button lint, or a new car, or whatever. And yes, there are people that will still buy it, and everyone will talk about how everything is doing hunky-dory and just wonderful. Wages are in decline. And the only saving grace we have right now is the price of petroleum is dropping. But if you look across the board at wages, we've not only had wage stagnation, but for the most part, wages are actually headed the wrong way. They're getting lower, not greater. And that was exactly what Alan Greenspan called for when he testified for Chuck Schumer. He referred to Americans with skills, and skilled labor, according to the immigration laws, doesn't mean necessarily a tradesman, although I am in awe of skilled tradesmen. My dad was a plumber. He was a tradesman, and he will always be my biggest hero. And his buddies who I grew up around were really amazing men. These were guys who no job was too dangerous, dirty, back-raking, or challenging. There was no such thing as mission impossible for these guys. Mission difficult, maybe. Impossible, they didn't know what that word meant. They did not know what the word impossible meant, to the point where I carried my dad off his job. He was dying of lung cancer. He was 57. I was 19. And in part, he got that terrible disease, I believe, because of the work he did during the Second World War in the Navy shipyards. And finally, that terrible rainy day, with a raspy voice, he called me and said, Mike, I'm done. I can't stay on the job anymore. You got to come get me. So I went and brought him home. And he was dead a couple of months later. That's the kind of conscientious workers that are getting fired. These are the conscientious workers today that the politicians talk about when they say the work Americans won't do. I mean, you know, you almost want to punch these guys in the mouth for saying such things about hardworking Americans. How in the world do we allow them to insult the people that built this country? I don't think American construction workers today, and I don't care what race, religion, or ethnicity, I'm talking about Americans, and at the end of the day, damn it, we're all Americans. They are the hardest working, most productive, most dedicated. They have this program on, if you haven't seen it, go watch it, The Dirtiest Jobs. You look at the work Americans do. The one job we better do is get rid of these damn politicians who are so arrogant that they think they can get away lying through their teeth every time their mouth opens. And so we get to where we are today. on September 11, 2001. Principally, it was failures of the immigration system that cost over 3,000 lives. The official number is under 3,000, but when you look at how many more people have died, the first responders, the construction workers, everybody who worked on what came to be known as the pile at Ground Zero, initially looking for survivors and then looking for the remains. They were exposed to all sorts of toxins. Their cancer rate is off the charts. And initially there were politicians in Washington who said, oh, we're not going to extend health benefits to these people. I mean, these politicians, folks, need to be run out of town on a rail. Maybe that's really the solution, you know? Handcuff them to a car and take them for a drive or something. I mean, this is insanity. And the 9/11 Commission was created to find out what went wrong. And that commission, by the way, was not unlike the commission that was created to find out why Space Shuttle Challenger blew up just seconds after liftoff, 72 seconds after liftoff. Not unlike the commission that was established to find out why Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrated in the skies over Texas as it returned from a mission. Not unlike the way that reports are issued when an airplane crashes to find out how an airliner became a smoking hole in the ground. And in each of those cases, whatever was found to be deficient was addressed. We had the Amtrak crash, same deal. And they found what was wrong, and they talked about how to fix it, and they're implementing it. Every time a life is lost, it is precious. It is irreplaceable. So this isn't about a numbers game. Although it is interesting that Joseph Stalin made a statement, and I remember going to a memorial service for the Holocaust and had the privilege of listening to the attorney Alan Dershowitz address the congregation, talking about mass murder, talking about terrorism, talking about the Holocaust. And he quoted, of all people, Joseph Stalin, because Stalin said something that was very interesting. And while Stalin was a despicable bit of human rubbish, he said something that bears thinking about. He said, one death is a tragedy, a million deaths is a... And the point that Stalin was making, and Dershowitz was using that point to make his point, is that if somebody kills somebody, there's a murder, whatever, and the guy flees the country, the odds are quite good that we will track that person down and bring him or her to justice, no matter where they go. You can run, you can't hide, for the most part. There are exceptions. We can certainly talk about some of our supposed friendly countries that won't allow us to extradite murderers. There's a whole bunch of issues there. But for the most part, we'll find you, we'll get you. And science has gotten so good at it. But what Dershowitz said was that as the body count goes up, the likelihood that the perpetrators will be caught and that they will be made to pay the price goes down. There's an inverse proportion. The greater the body count, the less likely there will be justice. And so he said that when you think about the Holocaust, the 6 million Jews, the 13 million people altogether who were slaughtered, forget that big number, 6 million, 13 million. He said, whatever the number is, multiply it by one. Multiply it by one, because each and every person killed is a separate and discrete murder. I spoke to one of the mothers of a firefighter who died on 9/11. And I had advised a group way back when called 9/11 Families for Secure America. And Joan talked to me about her son. He was a rookie firefighter. He was actually off duty. The bells rang. They told him he could go home. He said, no. He said, I hired on to save lives. I'm going with you. And he jumped on the truck, called his mom on the cell phone. It was the last time she ever heard from him. And, you know, we talked about that. And about how he tried so valiantly, and they all did. You know, that old saying, some gave, all gave some and some gave all. So, you know, the loss of that one life forever changed her life. And what she told me was, it really was hammered home to her when she got her son's death certificate and cause of death was listed as murder. 9/11 wasn't just a mass terror attack, it was a mass murder, okay? And you think about the extent to which we go as a country to try to protect ourselves. All these folks who are jumping up and down and saying, oh my gosh, you can only put 7 bullets in your gun in New York State because God only knows we're going to make people safe. It doesn't work. Terrorists don't care how many bullets they're putting in their illegal guns. Bank robbers, murderers, and gang members don't care about the bullets they're putting in their guns. And most law-abiding citizens don't go out and do crazy things. I mean, it may happen once in a rare while, but I assure you many more people are being killed by car accidents and people texting while driving and so forth than licensed gun owners going off and killing somebody. I happen to agree with background checks. I know some of you may not. We can have that disagreement. And by the way, we should have all sorts of disagreements as Americans and celebrate our differences. It's not weakness that we disagree, it's a strength. The fact that we are encouraged to disagree, that's why the First Amendment talks about the right for peaceable assemblage. You know, you ask people, what's the First Amendment? Freedom of press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion. They rattle it off. And they leave out the right to seek redress of grievances and the right for peaceable assemblage. Because the founding fathers understood you could not have a democratic republic without debate, discourse, perhaps argument. But they said do it peaceably. Leave the guns, the knives, and the clubs out of the discussion. Use your mouth, not your fists. And that's fine. And back in college, I was on the debating team. Had I not become a federal agent, I had given some very serious thought. Yes, my degree was in communications, arts, and sciences. To being a speech instructor and coach debating teams. Today, however, if you watch the supposed news programs on the major cable news networks, what you see for the most part are food fights. And two people come on very often without the credentials to have the conversation, and most people don't notice it. There's a movie making the rounds on cable TV you may want to watch called Man of the Year with Robin Williams. He plays the fictitious character, Tom Dobbs. I should have asked Lou Dobbs if what he thought of the fact that this character was named Tom Dobbs. And he's a talk show host kind of guy or a comedian, sort of like a Letterman sort of guy or a Jay Leno guy. And people are so upset with the politicians. He says, I ought to run for president. And the reaction he gets from his audience convinces him that maybe he should run. But at one point, his advisor says to him in the movie, one of the worst things ever created was the split screen. Because you could put two people up there. One guy is a true expert. The other guy dropped out of public school. And they're having this debate. But because of the split screen, everyone gives them equal credibility. I have debated immigration on the major cable networks with people who did a study. They spent 6 months or 8 weeks or whatever amount. Now they... immigration expert. He wrote a book. He shot a movie. Went down to the border and filmed for an hour. Or it was an hour's worth of film. He went down and filmed for 3 weeks. This is the guy I'm having a discussion with? You don't see it in any other area because this is the area that everyone is cashing in on. It's about slicing American wages. It's about moving American dollars out of our economy. And the banks get a piece of the action. The money wire services, the remitters get a piece of the action. You know, when Jeb Bush said, we can't afford to deport 11 million. I mean, that's the lame argument. And by the way, we probably have 30 to 40 million by now. I mean, you know, the flood continues, but the water level never rises. How does that happen? How does that happen? It's been 11 million for how many years now? I mean, I was born on a Wednesday, folks, not last Wednesday. But of course, the argument then is, well, we don't have enough money to deport 11 million, make it 40 million. Well, here's the point. If you look at how much money is being sent out of our country by foreign workers, both legal and illegal, the amount of money is staggering. It's over $200 billion a year. And if you add the multiplier effect, what you're really saying is that the money being wired from our country by foreign workers who have displaced American workers, that's what they've done, more than accounts for the annual increase in the U.S. national debt. Just stop and think about that. If we stopped hiring foreign workers, that act alone would cause our national debt to decrease. Right there and then, on the spot. Now let's add to that the fact that you would wind up taking some of those 93 million Americans who don't count when they come up with their unemployment numbers. This is worse than anything Russia ever did with their corrupt Pravda and Izvestia propaganda news services. How can you talk about the lowest unemployment levels in ages, 5.1%, while you ignore 93 million Americans of working age? This is delusional. This is something even Madoff wouldn't have had the chutzpah to try to pull off. And it's both parties. If we got rid of all those foreign workers and we employed millions of Americans who right now are on food stamps, right now getting subsidies of all sorts for housing and health insurance, do you realize that I'm not an economist or a statistician. I don't have the numbers in front of me. But just common sense tells you that if you did all that and wages went up and American consumers then went from being people depending on these safety net programs, and they would no longer be depending on the programs but would then again become tax-paying middle-class consumers that could drive the economy, we could turn around our national debt, I believe, in a couple of years. That's all it would take. But you see, then the banks wouldn't get to move the money out of our country, and they don't get their piece of the action. Look at the drug money. Look at the fact that demand for heroin has never been higher. It has gotten so bad that Governor Cuomo, a couple of weeks ago, said that he was going to allocate $272,000, almost $250,000, to provide nurses in a New York State public school system, I presume it's high school, but God only knows, with the antidote to heroin overdoses. So we've never had more people hooked on heroin with so much use, you would think the price of heroin would go through the roof, and just the opposite is happening. The price keeps dropping. Well, anybody who took economics in junior high school knows that if the demand increases, price has to go up unless the supply has gotten even bigger than the demand. I would submit to you folks that that's exactly what has happened. That's the measure of border security. There ain't none, as someone might say. Our border is as porous as a sieve. It is nothing more than a speed bump. So if you can bring heroin into the United States in that quantity, how hard would it be to bring in a weapon of mass destruction? How hard would it be to bring in terrorists? How hard would it be to bring in cartel members? Violence is going up. You have cities declaring themselves sanctuaries, making a mockery of the laws that stand as our first and last line of defense against international terrorists and transnational criminals. And if you dare say enforce the law, oh my God, when Donald Trump stood there, because he wasn't bought and paid for, not like those political prostitutes that he has to swim around every day. Goodness gracious. You know, I have done so many hearings in Washington. I wish they had listenings. And most times, with some of these people, my first urge when I walk out of the hearing room is to take a hot shower with a disinfectant soap and a Brillo soap pad. And Trump keeps talking about it, and he's right. And I'm not saying I'm endorsing his candidacy, but I endorse this statement. We'll see who to endorse as this thing progresses. But I am looking optimistically to Trump at the moment, but we have a long way to go. But he said, look, I'm not taking anybody's money. You know, if some poor schnook wants to send me $10, $20, whatever, I'll take it. But my understanding is that he makes people sign a declaration that they are not part of a union or a corporation or a political action committee. He doesn't want any influence peddlers peddling their influence with him. So he can stand there and tell these people to go jump in the lake, which scares the hell out of them. Because all of a sudden you have a guy who says, I don't want the money. Because if I take your money today, I'm going to have to take your phone call tomorrow. And he doesn't want those phone calls. Because you see, if you look at the way that the 9/11 Commission warned us about immigration, this is a no-brainer. It's the equivalent of having a bunch of burglaries in your neighborhood and home invasion, and the cops come around, like the 9/11 Commission, and they say to you, hey, look, there's a gang of home invaders. They're heavily armed. They're very violent. They're not happy to take your valuables, because after you give them all the valuables, they're going to behead you. They're going to shoot you. They're going to rape and slaughter you. They're going to do all kinds of terrible things. But by sunrise, you'll be dead. So what you need to do is lock your door. Do you know any homeowner who would laugh and say, oh, no, I'm going to leave my front door wide open because I don't want to be antisocial? Because that, ladies and gentlemen, is what the 9/11 Commission warned us about. They made it clear that it were the failures of the immigration system that enabled the terrorists to enter our country. So what are we doing to make certain that the terrorists can't get into the United States? Well, let's see. On 9/11, we had 26 visa waiver countries, which means that the aliens from those countries don't need to have a visa to come to the United States. And the 9/11 Commission said, hey, listen, you got to change that dynamic. This is very dangerous. You have got to have a stricter routine in terms of the way you issue visas. Just the way it is, you must do a better job of scrutinizing people who are seeking to enter your country. So on 9/11, we had 26 visa waiver countries. You would have thought that that would have ended. You would have thought that everybody would have said, okay, well, we got to do away with the visa waiver program because this is very dangerous. Well, guess what, folks? The visa waiver program was expanded, and they went from 26 visa waiver countries on 9/11, and today, guess what? Today we actually have 38 visa waiver countries. How does that make any sense to anybody? Can someone explain this to me? How in the world do you go from 28 visa waiver countries, 26 visa waiver countries, to 38, and they're still looking to expand the number? You see, when you see things like that, you realize that something is wrong. So let's tell you what's wrong here. The United States Chamber of Commerce, some local chambers are wonderful. I was just in Pennsylvania with the local Chamber of Commerce. They're excellent. I was a participant in a television program about the Iranian deal. Happy to be there. And so they try to do the right thing. But the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, you can forget about it. They have developed this program, and it's been ongoing for years, and George W. Bush was part of this nonsense too, the Discover America Partnership. They have partnered with the hotel, hospitality, and travel industries. And what they're doing is pushing to basically do away with the visa requirement altogether. Can you picture anything worse than that? They actually want to do away with the visa requirement altogether if they could get away with it. Of course, that's a bit of a problem, but meanwhile, we've gone from 26 to 38 visa waiver countries. And I've done all kinds of articles for The Social Contract, for Front Page Magazine, for CapsWeb.org, where I listed the six benefits to having a good visa process. Number one, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, got on board that airplane without a visa. And then he tried to set off the bombs that he concealed in his shoes. Why? Because he was a Brit. British nationals don't need visas to come to the United States. And as Europe admits more refugees, and more of those refugees eventually become British citizens and citizens of other European countries, we need to worry about who we are admitting. And if you watch the TV programs and they bring in the CIA analysts and all the others, they all talk about why it is that Al-Qaeda and ISIS and these terrorist organizations are trying to recruit Westerners. Number one, they want people to have blonde hair and blue eyes so that they don't fit the profile. Number two, they don't need visas to come to the United States. So you would think that we would say, okay, we've got to end the program. Well, the Discover America Partnership, led by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, including hotel, hospitality, travel industry executives, have spent tons of money, I mean probably hundreds of millions of dollars, convincing politicians to expand the visa waiver program, this Discover America Partnership, which is stupid, because if, God forbid, there's another terrorist attack, as we saw on 9/11, it was an act of heroism to get on an airplane and fly to a place like New York. Nobody went anywhere. The hotels were empty. Some hotels went out of business. Times Square, forget about it. Broadway, nothing there. Nobody wanted to travel. People were scared to death. If, God forbid, there's another attack, you will be able to take airport runways and turn them into parking lots because no one's going to go anywhere. Yes, maybe it deters some people from traveling. That's okay. That's acceptable to you to make sure that more people travel and fill the seats on the airplanes and sleep on those beds in the hotels and go to the baseball games in the hotels and buy trinkets, even if it costs thousands of lives? Really? This is a game of Russian roulette, and it's innocent lives hanging in the balance because of a bunch of greedy thugs. These are the same people who want more foreign workers to come to America, even as we're destroying middle-class families. They don't care. They don't care. Yes, maybe the American families aren't spending the money they would spend otherwise, but somehow the equation works for them so far. All that the executives at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce care about is money. They have as much scruples as Willie Sutton. I bet Willie Sutton had more scruples than these thugs do. Just all they care about is money. The hell with America, the hell with Americans, the hell with American middle-class families or their children. We're told, well, if you want to secure the border, you lack compassion. Folks, 1 in 4 American children live below the poverty line. We are at risk of another terrorist attack. We have naturalized terrorists. One of the Tsarnaev brothers who attacked the Boston Marathon was a naturalized citizen. The other had applied for citizenship. Ray Kelly called Faisal Shahzad, the Times Square bomber, a classic example of a homegrown terrorist, but the guy came here at the age of 20 on a student visa from Pakistan. Ray Kelly knows better than that, but he knew that he had to placate Bloomberg, the guy that was obsessed with salt and sugar but never said a word about heroin or cocaine. We have the same thing now with Mayor Dumb Blasio here in New York City. They want to put little salt shaker logos on menus if they put a little too much salt in your food. Where are the little logos that show little hypodermic needles, perhaps, for the heroin that's being ingested? And you've got the AMA, the American Medical Association, saying that it's acceptable to give 11-year-old kids oxycodone when they need painkillers? Really? It's one of the most addictive prescription medications in the world. How many pharmacy robberies have there been over oxycodone? So now they're going to expand it to 11-year-olds. This is all about money over everything else, folks. And meanwhile, we are on the precipice of admitting a tidal wave of refugees who cannot be vetted. You know, it's just so astonishing. And by the way, here's something. This is on page 12 of the 9/11 Commission report, and it's in this paper, for lack of a better word, my analysis that I did for the social contract. So this is the 9/11 report. Before 9/11, no agency of the U.S. government systematically analyzed terrorists' travel strategies. Had they done so, they could have discovered the ways in which terrorist predecessors to Al-Qaeda had been systematically but detectably exploiting weaknesses in our border security since the early 1990s. We found that as many as 15 of the 19 hijackers were potentially vulnerable to interception by border authorities. Analyzing their characteristic travel documents and travel patterns could have allowed authorities to intercept 4 of the 15 hijackers, and more effective use of information available to U.S. government databases could have identified up to 3 more hijackers. Looking back, we can also see that the routine operations of our immigration laws, that is, aspects of those laws not specifically aimed at protecting against terrorism, inevitably shaped Al-Qaeda's planning and opportunities. Because they were deemed not to be bona fide tourists or students, as they claimed, 5 conspirators that we know of tried to get visas and failed, and 1 was denied entry by an inspector. We also found that had the immigration system set a higher bar for determining whether individuals are or who or what they claim to be, and ensuring routine consequences for violations, it could have potentially excluded, removed, or come into further contact with several hijackers who did not appear to meet the terms for admitting short-term visitors. We're talking about routine immigration law enforcement. So when you have the administration saying, we're only going to go after aliens who've been convicted of committing serious crimes, What we're telling Al-Qaeda is that if your people enter the United States, they need to be careful to not commit any crimes other than their method of entry, maybe getting fake identity documents, but keep a low profile. Somebody once said that an effective spy is somebody who would not attract the attention of a waiter or waitress at a greasy spoon diner. That's exactly the point with the terrorists as well. I assure you that Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of the terrorists of 9/11, probably smiled at people that he passed in the street every day when he left wherever it was he was living as he went about his day-to-day business. Probably smiled, nodded, seemed very pleasant, probably made eye contact. How many times do you hear the story? Guy kills 15 people, and then they interview the neighbor. Wow, it's hard to believe. He was such a nice guy. He always smiled at me, and he mowed his lawn, and he really took care of his roses. Folks, this isn't about crabgrass. We are so naive because the guy smiled. He seemed like a nice guy. I mean, wow. And that's why routine enforcement. In fact, I'm in the middle of another paper for the social contract, and I've written about this in other articles. There's something that is called randomness in law enforcement. And what randomness says is that if law enforcement routinely stops people for small infractions of law, ultimately you're going to encounter some pretty serious characters. I read an estimate, and I'm still trying to find where I read it many years ago, that estimated that half of the FBI's 10 most wanted are not arrested by the FBI. The FBI takes credit for the arrest most of the time, to be blunt about it. But usually it's a cop stopping somebody for speeding. I remember years ago I got a call from my friends over in the 71st Police Precinct in Brooklyn, Crown Heights. They had pulled a car over with two black individuals with dreadlocks down to the middle of their back. The guy had blown a red light. They pulled him over. And this one guy got out of the car, and he actually took a swing at the cop. And you had to know the cop. It was kind of crazy. Big Italian-American kid. I'm sure he ate a lot of his mother's pasta and veal parmesan, because this guy had I called him a member of the no-neck club. He had like a 25-inch neck, big shoulders, big arms. My goodness, he looked like Arnold Schwarzenegger on steroids, on top of the steroids that Arnold took. This guy was a mountain with feet, and the cop didn't budge. The guy took a swing at him, and he hit the guy one shot. The guy went down, broke his jaw, and out popped the gun. They hauled him off. I got a phone call. I ran the fingerprints, and the people at Central Booking were very dubious. They said, well, we ran the prints. Nothing came back. I said, well, I'm going to run them through the FBI, because I had access to a computer in those days using a special fax machine. It was a relic compared to what we do today. This was back in the late 70s, early 80s. They put the fingerprint card on a drum, and it would spin for about 8 to 10 minutes, and the prints would ultimately be wired down to Washington. And it turned out that these two individuals from Trinidad were about to be put on the FBI's 10 most wanted list for bank robberies. If my memory serves me correctly, they had done something on the order of 20 bank robberies and killed a number of people. And how did the guy get arrested? Running a red light. And you know what? If he had simply given the cop his license and registration, which he had on him, by the way, they would have given him a ticket, and he would have gone on his merry way. But, you see, these are crazy people. These are sociopathic, wacky people. But there are others out there who understand the need to be careful. And, by the way, I got a very nice letter from the Joint Bank Robbery Task Force, my partner and I, which had FBI agents teamed up with members of the New York City Police Department, because they were thrilled to put these guys in jail. They will probably spend the rest of their lives in a cage, and rightfully so. But it's the routine police work, the routine stop, that makes these things happen. When I was a brand new agent, my very first case that I was going to work on alone was to interview an Israeli young man who came in with an altered visa. Take a deposition, they told me. He's going back to Israel. He has an altered visa. I said, okay. He kept calling Israel Palestine. One thing led to another. I found a document on him. And what the document was, as it turned out, was a map, a schematic of the oil refinery in Israel. He was here to get the money so his cohorts could plant the explosives and destroy the refinery. We prevented the attack. All because he was stopped at the airport for having an altered visa. Nobody had a clue that that this guy was a member of the PLO. Routine immigration law enforcement. Routine law enforcement in general yields all kinds of results, which is why car stops are one of the most dangerous activities law enforcement can do. Because you're throwing your hook into a very deep ocean, and you catch a fish, and you have no idea who the fish is. And so now you have Mayor Dumb Blasio in New York giving hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens identity documents. Oh, these poor people, they just want to work. Right, like Mohammed Atta wanted to work, like this Israeli kid just wanted to work. You see, this is a level of stupidity and naivete. It blows my mind. Sanctuary cities blow my mind. And let me tell you something, folks. Mayor Rudy Giuliani had sanctuary policies in place. In February of 2003, I believe it was, I was called before the House Immigration Subcommittee because of Bloomberg's sanctuary policies, and they immediately said, wait a minute, we inherited those policies from Giuliani. And they did. And in 1986, I had physically put an illegal alien, a guy who had a green card, lost it because of drug convictions, a guy by the name of Ronaldo Rayside from Panama, put him on an airplane. We deported him. He was back in the United States very quickly, gets arrested twice by the New York City Police Department, but because of Rudy Giuliani's sanctuary policies, they couldn't tell us about this guy, that they had him in custody, and that mere act of reentering is a felony, and because of a law that I worked with Al D'Amato to create today, that felony calls for a max of 20 years in jail for criminal aliens who get deported and come back illegally. But even though this guy committed a serious felony by reentering the United States, their hands were tied. If they had called me up and said, we've got a guy and he's an illegal alien, under Giuliani's policies, they were looking at disciplinary action. God knows what they would have done to them. We are tying the hands of law enforcement, specifically where immigration is concerned. So twice this guy gets grabbed by the cops, and twice we're not told. The third time we did find out about it because he killed a 24-year-old police officer by the name of Robert Machete. I testified at the murder trial. Robert Machete's wife was pregnant with their daughter. I got to meet her by accident when I went to my supermarket 20 years later. She was working as a checkout girl, wearing a miniature badge. We started to chat. It was devastating. These aren't victimless crimes. And then I listened to Mr. Gutfeld on Fox News the other day, and he's very funny. They're all very affable. I've met many of these people. I've never been on the set with Gutfeld, but I've been on the set with many of these other people. I like them personally. But the foolishness that we hear from all of them makes me nuts. He said, you know what? The biggest threat we're facing, not Obamacare, not the economy, certainly not immigration, it's terrorism. And I have to tell you, I am sitting there listening to Gutfeld, and my anger starts bubbling up because I'm thinking, don't you understand that you don't even know what you're talking about, but you're giving people wrong ideas. You're giving people wrong ideas. How many times have you turned on to, I don't care what network, I don't care which of the three cable networks, I don't care about ABC, NBC, the same nonsense, we hear it all the time. We hear it all the time. Well, if these people have been living here for 7 years, and they haven't committed any crime, there's absolutely no reason why we should be sending them out of the country. Okay, what's the question that someone should ask them? How long is someone living here? How do you make that determination? There is no capacity to do any face-to-face interviews. There is no capacity to do field investigations. And these are people who, by running the border, gained entry to our country, means that you can't just go into a computer database and punch in the guy's name. Oh, and by the way, we don't know what the guy's name is, do we? Because he's quote-unquote undocumented. And say, well, when did he enter the United States? We have no idea if the guy got here 7 years ago, 7 weeks ago, or 7 minutes ago. But that's not what they say. Charles Krauthammer seems to be a nice guy. His story is inspirational. But Krauthammer made that point a couple of months ago. And, you know, it's frustrating. You sit there and you scream at the TV, and I'm saying, God damn it, Charles, don't you understand what you're doing? You're spewing misinformation. I know you don't mean to. I know you're a bright guy and you're apparently a decent, honorable human being. But why are you making statements that you know nothing about? I've been on many programs where the host will say to me, well, Mr. Cutler, where our military actions in Afghanistan are concerned, what's your position? And you know what my answer is? You're asking the wrong guy. I've never been in the military. I'm certainly not somebody who knows enough about the military to have an opinion worth spit. Call up my friend Paul Vallely, Major General Vallely, who retired from the U.S. Army. He's an expert. He used to, in fact, be the Fox News senior military guy. Call up Paul. He's a guy you should listen to because he knows this stuff in and out, backwards, sideways, and upside down. Not me. You want to know about immigration? I'm your guy. You want to know about neurosurgery? Call up Ben Carson. I think he knows a little more than I do. Let's have a little humility. And when we have these talking heads on TV, as I started to make notice of earlier, why is it that when they do talk about the military, they do try to bring in people like Paul Vallely, as they should? When they talk about cancer, they bring in neurologists and neuroscientists and biologists and chemists and so forth and pathologists, and they should, geneticists. But when they talk about immigration, they bring in political pundits, and I wish we could get rid of them. These pollsters don't know what the hell they're talking about, except it's all about an industry for them. I don't know who they're polling or how they ask the questions, but what they come up with for the most part is sheer garbage. And you have scared little children running for elected office that will take any position at whatsoever as long as it polls well. Is that leadership? Is that how Eisenhower put together Operation Overlord, D-Day? Do you think Eisenhower and Patton went out and conducted a damn poll? Well, we did a poll. Survey says. I feel like I'm watching Family Feud. Survey says. Are you kidding me? This is how politicians formulate policy based on the bribes they've accepted, which are nothing more than, because that's what a campaign contribution is, or a poll. It's astonishing. So they bring in the pollsters. They bring in a radio talk show host. They bring in all kinds of people to talk about immigration. And everybody thinks, oh, immigration, that's a minor topic. It's about people washing dishes and putting roofs on houses. And people that just want to, they want to be American. Unbelievable. You saw what I just read, a little snippet from the 9/11 Commission report. There are hundreds of pages of that material. Between that and the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel, in detail about how the terrorists were using visa fraud, immigration benefit fraud, claiming to be married, going to school, all the tactics that they used. I testified at that hearing. I know I've mentioned it before. It's worth repeating on 9/11 today about Muhammad Atta and Marwan al-Shehhi getting permission to go to flight school 6 months after the attacks, and all the promises that were made by those politicians were never kept. There's such a serious implication for national security. I mean, think of D-Day and all the soldiers charging the beach at Normandy. I mean, isn't that what immigration is about when you stop and think about it? Yes, when you go to the airport and you see all these people waiting online and they're wearing civilian clothing and it's very peaceful and, you know, the guy inspects them and, you know, you get a minute to make a decision. God help us all. Well, that's just people traveling. But if among them are the terrorists and the people who want to kill us, it really is almost like D-Day. It almost is the beach at Normandy. You know, if you want to think about this, and here's an image for you to conjure up in your mind the next time you hear some Nimrod talking about immigration. In the Second World War, you know, they've made all these great movies, and you see the commandos, and they're sitting there side by side in the military transport plane, probably a DC-3, or in the military they call them C-47s or Goonie Birds. And they're sitting there shoulder to shoulder in their combat gear and their parachutes. And they got, you know, grease paint on their face to darken their face. And they've got their helmets on and they've got their rifles. and they go out the door and they jump in the dead of night behind enemy lines. Well, they jump behind enemy lines to take out facilities. You know, they're commandos. They're going to blow up the generators. And, okay, great. They have to get behind the enemy lines. Today, folks, when terrorists seek to get behind enemy lines, they get on an airliner and they fly into John F. Kennedy International Airport, Miami, O'Hare, LAX. That's how the terrorists get behind enemy lines. Or they probably are running the Mexican border, or perhaps they're stowing away on ships. They don't have to jump out of airplanes in the middle of the night. They walk off an airplane in the middle of the day with a passport from a European country because they don't need a visa. Do you understand the level of the threat? But all that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce can think about is, wow, that guy paid for that seat on that airplane. And he bought a sandwich. Wow, we made money off of him. And maybe he'll go to a baseball game. I mean, that's what national security has come down to? The fact that the people responsible for room service and hopefully clean linen in our hotel rooms when we go on a vacation or a business trip, those people responsible for the room service and clean sheets are now making national security decisions for America, for you, for me, for our children, for our grandchildren? Is that what it's come down to? Because believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen, that's exactly what it's come down to. It's exactly what it's come down to. And so you had Donald Trump speaking the truth. And you had an army of politicians and lobbyists, call them the bribers, if you will, the pollsters, the so-called journalists, goodness gracious, talking heads, people who flunk the wiggle test. If you don't know what the wiggle test is, you stick your left finger in your left ear, your right finger in your right ear, you wiggle your fingertips. If the fingertips touch, you flunk the test. They're vibrating. You're not supposed to talk about murderers and rapists coming to America from Mexico. Oh, this is terrible. Donald Trump, oh, he just lost the Latino vote. And then they sit there scratching their heads because the pollsters, as inept and foolish as that whole process is, come out and they go, you know, the Latinos like Trump. Folks, do you know what a disservice this is? This BS about the Latino vote, this monolithic vote, all Latinos are alike. Why don't they just say those people? Right? Those people. The Jewish vote. Yes, all Jews are alike, aren't we? Remarkable. My friend Mark Hager is a college professor in North Carolina. I spoke at two of his classes, and then they arranged a speaking event. The sheriffs there really took wonderful care of me. They let me play around on their computerized shoot, don't shoot, pistol range, the most advanced program I've ever seen. You know, I've been retired for quite a while now. It's hard for me to believe. It's been since November 99 that I was last on duty. That's 16 years ago. I had fun for 2 hours playing around on this computer simulation. It was as real as it gets, let me tell you, without getting blood on yourself, being spattered when you do shoot the bad guy. And I said to these kids in this class, because he had, I don't know, perhaps a dozen black American kids in the classroom. And we were talking about this profiling, because that's what it is, the Latino vote, the black vote, the Jewish vote. And I said, well, if we believe that there's any credibility, any reasonableness to the notion of the black vote, there's an obvious question that I have to ask you. All the black students, are you all studying the same course of studies? And of course they weren't. So what happened to the notion of the black vote? You mean you have black kids sitting in a classroom with a diversity of major? You mean they don't all want the same thing? And then I said, what about the white students? You know, we always get left out of these polls because we're only white, only. So every white kid in the class is majoring in the same subject? Everybody has the same career goal? And they started laughing. I said, do you understand that this is no less preposterous than talking about the Latino vote? that anybody whose last name is Garcia wants our immigration laws ignored, wants our borders to be left wide open, wants narcotics to flow into the country. I mean, basically, when these people talk about the Latino vote wanting all these people to be given lawful status, what they're really saying is that Latinos are lawless. Think of how many Americans who are multi-generational. I mean, I'm only one generation. My dad was born in America. His family came here from Russia, Romania. My mom came from Poland, so I'm really first generation. Imagine someone who's fifth generation, whose last name is Garcia, and maybe all of the men in his family served in the Marine Corps, going back to, you know, the Civil War or the Revolutionary War or whatever. The point is, you've got statements about Latinos that they advocate providing amnesty to millions of people who violate our borders and violate our laws, and that's the only way that they get a vote for a politician is if they go along with such insanity. And if you ask most people, what's the most likely name of an illegal alien, they're going to tell you Garcia, Rodriguez, you know. Why? It's estimated nearly half of the illegal aliens in our country didn't run the border but came through ports of entry. We have millions of illegal aliens who didn't come from Latin America and don't speak Spanish. Do you realize how crazy this whole deal is? As an immigration agent, I arrested people and investigated people for years where I didn't even speak to anybody who spoke Spanish. I worked on a case involving Asian organized crime, another case that involved a Jamaican drug posse. I've arrested Israeli murderers. I've arrested a suspected IRA terrorist who was sending bomb detonators back to Ireland. So, I mean, what in the world does this have to do with a Latino vote? And so all of a sudden, the pollsters, much as I can't stand them, they actually did a survey and they said, you know, a lot of Latinos like Donald Trump. Of course they do. Why wouldn't they? But you see, there is this mythology, this narrative, and it's a lie. And it's being pushed on us by people that don't care about America or Americans. It's all about greed. Just like you hear these people on TV say, oh, if only they would pass comprehensive immigration reform, the problem would be solved. How does that solve the problem? We're going to give millions of people identity documents, even though we don't have the ability to interview them or investigate them. And I could read to you chapter and verse about how the legal immigration system was the system that was most often used by the terrorists because we were giving them immigration status without any integrity to the process. That's where the vulnerability is. And if you try to go to the DHS website and find out how many people work for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, guess what? Those numbers are no longer there. They have taken those numbers off the website. They will still tell you that there are 45,000 people working for TSA. There are over 20,000 Border Patrol agents. There are over 20,000 immigration inspectors and people working with that process at ports of entry. But the one number that you will never find anymore is how many ICE agents there are. In 2013, the last year they posted those statistics, we had about 7,000 ICE agents. More than half of them were doing customs work. We had 20,000-plus Border Patrol agents. So do the math. Six times more Border Patrol agents than immigration agents. And what the Border Patrol does is important. It's interdiction. But it's a special agent who is supposed to make certain that people don't lie on their applications for immigration benefits. They're supposed to go after people who employ illegal aliens and arrest the illegal aliens, God forbid. They're supposed to work with the jail system to make certain that when criminal aliens come out of jail, they're picked up and deported. There's so many missions. They are also assigned, as I was, to the Drug Task Force. We have immigration agents assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And you may not know this, because when you think about the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the first thing that pops into everyone's mind, oh, FBI. Well, that's right. The FBI runs the JTTF, Joint Terrorism Task Force. But guess which agency sends the second greatest number of agents to participate in the JTTF? ICE. because international terrorists almost always commit visa fraud or otherwise violate immigration laws, and they could not do their job at JTTF without ICE agents on board. Is that ever portrayed in the media? Of course not. Because ICE agents are just supposed to chase after people who are mowing lawns and washing cars and washing dishes at the back of Greasy Spoon diners. It's the big fat lie, the big fat narrative. And now we're being told that out of compassion, we're going to be taking in tens of thousands of refugees from a war-torn part of the world that is dysfunctional. There is no functioning government for all intents and purposes. And I mean, really, do you think Assad of Syria is going to say, oh, we'll open up the records so you could see who these people are? I mean, we're trying to remove Assad. I mean, this whole thing is in such a state of meltdown. And it all happened because we went into a hornet's nest. We probably shouldn't have. We did. Now we're paying the price. But the idea that you're going to bring in people from countries that sponsor terrorism and that with them are terrorists who will see in this an opportunity to gain entry into our country is an act of suicide and stupidity. And I'll tell you, there's an interesting article that you should check out, and I'm probably going to wind up writing an article about it. But on November 10th, 2014, Newsweek magazine published a story, and it was called Inside the CIA's Syrian Rebels Vetting Machine. And it talked all about how we have no idea who these rebels are. So let me just read the first two paragraphs, because you're going to be amazed, I think, I hope. Now, this was November 10th last year, almost a full year ago. Nothing has come in for more mockery during the Obama administration's halting steps into the Syrian civil war than its employment of, quote, moderate, unquote, to describe the kind of rebels it is willing to back. In one of the more widely cited japes, the New Yorker's resident humorist, Andy Borowitz, presented a, quote, moderate Syrian application form, unquote, in which applicants were asked to describe themselves as being either A, moderate, B, very moderate, C, crazy moderate, or D, other. After Senator John McCain allegedly posed with Syrians that were supposedly on our side, who turned out to be kidnappers, a report later called into question John Stewart cracked, not everyone is going to be wearing their hello, I'm a terrorist name badge. John Stewart was right. But yet, I guess, the administration expects that the people we bring here as refugees will be wearing that name badge. You think? Do the people that we elected to represent us, to uphold the Constitution and the laws of the United States, at what point are we going to finally make them accountable? At what point are we going to say enough? Enough. You know, with all the speculation about Iran and whether they're going to get a nuclear weapon, and I believe they will. I think this is a very bad agreement. It's a very dangerous agreement. But let me tell you something. With all this talk about that, this agreement will also allow Iran to dip into tens of billions of dollars of cash that we have seized. How much damage could you do with billions of dollars when you have terrorist clients such as Hezbollah and Hamas operating inside our hemisphere? There are Iranian shock troops arriving each and every week directly into Caracas, Venezuela from Tehran, Iran. We have terrorists operating in the tri-border region of Brazil with their terror training camps. That's where Brazil abuts with Argentina and Paraguay. So let's say they don't get nuclear weapons, and I'm fearful they will. I'm fearful they will. But let's, for the moment, push that aside. Simply freeing up tens of billions of dollars, do you not believe that with conventional weaponry, The body count could be astronomical. I mean, what did it cost for those 19 terrorists to get on those airplanes and use them as de facto cruise missiles? And we keep on playing yesterday's game. They used airplanes, so okay, we now have 45,000. 45,000. Let me repeat that again. 45,000 TSA people. That is more than the number of Border Patrol agents and Customs and Border Protection inspectors combined. How many airplanes were used at the Boston Marathon bombing? When Faisal Shahzad attempted to blow up that SUV in Times Square, how many airplanes were involved? Turning a terrorist loose in the United States is like turning a kid loose with a platinum credit card at Toys R Us. They are limited only by their imagination. Do we need to make airplanes safe? Absolutely. But maybe a good first step would be to eliminate the visa waiver program to help keep terrorists off the airplanes in the first place. Maybe. But then God only knows, they'd have to have a couple of empty seats on those airplanes. And wow, that's just so high a price to pay. You see what's really happening, folks? Short-term profits trump national security, trump the lives of innocent people, ultimately trump the survival of our nation. If America stops being a world power, the world will be plunged into chaos and darkness. Because you see, it's not as though if the United States is no longer the lead dog that Germany or Canada, France, or Japan will take the lead. No, no. We could deal with that. We really could. Because waiting in the wings are Russia, China, and Iran. Russia, China, and Iran. How do you think that would play out? And we are educating many of the people who are building the militaries of these other countries. I wrote about that in my most recent article for Front Page Magazine about educating our adversaries. We are doing all sorts of crazy things in the United States because we have amoral leaders who do not care about anything other than getting their campaign contributions. As a federal agent, I was not allowed to accept so much as a cup of coffee from anybody. I worked with the Japanese government. I helped them to make a final arrest of a major cocaine smuggling ring that was operating between the United States and Tokyo. And I helped them to capture the last person, the smallest of all the players. I don't mean height-wise. I'm not sure if she was the smallest that way. But in terms of severity of the crime. And I convinced her to give herself up, which she did. She went home and was put on trial. And I got a very nice police medal and a certificate. And I was taken to lunch by the Japanese Consul General. So two things had to be done before I could go to lunch and before I could take that medal home. Number one, I had to bring that medal to my boss. And in those days, and he passed away recently, I miss him terribly, Walter Connery was the head of investigations in New York. Prior to that, he was the head of internal affairs for INS in Washington. Prior to that, he was the head of internal affairs for the New York City Police Department. And he was an attorney, and he was a sort of mentor to me because I've done expert witness testimony, and he was always the guy that I went to for advice in terms of billing situations and so forth so that, you know, things work properly. And I had to go to Walter and say, in those days, of course, I wouldn't call him by his first name. That only happened after I retired. I said to Mr. Connery, I just got this award. And he said, well, I don't think it's worth more than $25. You're allowed to keep it. And I said, you know, I'm about to be taken to lunch by the Japanese Consul General. And he said, you need to call up Internal Affairs, the Office of Professional Responsibility, and advise them. And I did. And they said to me, if you did not attend this lunch, would it hurt your professional relationship with the Japanese government? I said, I imagine that it would. They said, under those circumstances, enjoy your lunch. If I had simply gone and had lunch that was paid for by the Japanese Consul General, I could have been in very serious trouble. To the point, God only knows, maybe even a criminal prosecution. You don't just accept gifts, especially from foreign governments. So I had to go on record, and they could have said no, and I would have had to call back and tell the guy, thank you for your hospitality, I can't accept it. Fortunately, I was able to. The same thing with the Israeli National Police. I worked with them closely ever since I uncovered that terror plot back in 1976. But routinely, I notified the folks at Professional Responsibility that I'm going to have dinner with the Consul General and so forth. And you know, they made a point of saying, look, but today I insist that I'll be paying and so forth. Because you really want to be very careful. You know, I used to have a boss who had been the head of internal affairs before, Walter Connery, a guy by the name of Frank Johnson, and the guy I had tremendous respect for. And he always used to have this cigarette in his hand, and he would jab the air with the cigarette to separate the syllables and the things that he talked about. And he had a wonderful expression. And he always used to say to us, if there was only two women that were agents in those days, so he'd look around to see if any of the women were there, and if they weren't, he would say, gentlemen. If they were there, gentlemen and lady, usually singular. It was rare that we were all at the same place at the same time. He would say, as federal agents, it's not enough that you don't engage in wrongdoing. You must never even give the illusion of doing wrong. Think about that. A cup of coffee was seen as a possible problem. All sorts of things were off the list. I had lunch one day and noticed an attorney I had recognized as an agent sitting near me. I moved my plate over to him. I was having my dessert. The bill came. I paid for my food. He paid for his food. One of my bosses walked by, looked into the restaurant, saw me sitting with this guy having a cup of coffee, walked into the restaurant. He said to me, Mr. Cutler, finish your lunch. When you're upstairs, come see me. And I got my tail chewed out because he said to me, listen, you're having lunch with an attorney who represents aliens who you arrest. It appears inappropriate. I said, I paid for my own dessert. He said, I don't doubt it. But think of what it looks like. Think of what it looks like. You know, if you're out on Long Island somewhere far away from the office, it's one thing. But he said, you're an agent, and there are people who recognize you, and you're sitting in this restaurant having what looks like lunch with an attorney who represents people you arrest. It gives a lousy impression. Don't do it again. When you are a police officer, I have friends who are cops, I applied for the PD, they're careful. They are not allowed to go to certain restaurants or bars or places that are believed to have affiliation with organized crime. It's about the appearances. It's about the illusion. All those great politicians who are beating the snot out of law enforcement, creating this divisive situation. Would that those politicians live by the same standards as federal agents and police officers, these sanctimonious elected officials. Now, again, there are some good guys, you know, Jeff Sessions, Lou Barletta, Chuck Grassley, and there's a list. But so many of these people, Louis Gohmert, I had the privilege of being with Louis in Florida, along with John Fleming and Jeff Sessions. These are good people. I hope they continue to run, which is why I don't like the term limit business. To me, the term limit should be in the ballot box for members of Congress. But how many politicians could withstand the same scrutiny that federal agents or members of our military is subjected to when we have security clearances? The level of betrayal that we are witnessing at a particularly perilous era is unnerving. We need to have politicians who put America and Americans first. This has never been a more important issue than it is today. And it's funny because somehow when the sun is in the right part of the sky and September 11th rolls around, you just know in your heart of hearts it's September 11th, especially on a clear day, and you are transported back all those years to that god-awful day where the sky was crystal clear, visibility unlimited, and two airplanes slammed into the World Trade Center here in New York City. Nobody who was in New York on that day is the same. We all suffer post-traumatic stress. I was talking to my friend Bruce DeSalle, former New York City police officer. His son-in-law was obliterated on 9/11. His father, this kid's father, was a fire chief. So picture this. The two guys, fire chief, New York City cop, former cop, on the phone, worrying about where this kid is. And he had just been given a promotion, because normally he didn't work at the World Trade Center. But on that day, I believe he worked for Cantor Fitzgerald. They said, why don't you come up and have a cup of coffee? We're going to make the announcement that we're giving you a promotion. He told his wife the night before, we're going to finally start having babies because with this promotion, we'll be able to afford it. What Bruce told me is they believe that he was in the elevator when the airplane struck. He was on his way out of the building. If he had just left a couple of minutes earlier. And so Bruce told me that he went to this hearing that they just held at Ground Zero on Tuesday, and they brought in Giuliani. And for all the talk they did, not one word about immigration, by the way. Nobody talked about New York sanctuary policies and how it undermines national security or public safety. Of course not. And they brought in the first responders other than Rudy Giuliani. Well, that makes sense. The people that clean up the mess after there's a disaster. But Bruce told me that walking, as he did, to that hearing, took him down the same street that he had walked when he was looking for his son-in-law after the attack. And it left him shaken. And I told him, I said, I understand completely. I had lost both of my parents, my first wife, to cancer many years ago. My parents have been gone, it's hard for me to believe this, over 45 years now. Wife is gone about 30 years. And yet when I go by Memorial Hospital where they were diagnosed, they had their surgery there and so forth, to this day I get that sick feeling in my gut. They died of disease. On 9/11, 3,000 healthy people were obliterated because our government refused to learn the lessons that the 1993 terror attacks carried out at the CIA and the World Trade Center should have taught us, should have taught them. They refused to learn the lessons of history. They flat out refused to learn the lessons of history. This is unforgivable, folks. And yet that's exactly where we are today. Totally unforgivable. And yet we are putting ourselves in a position where, God forbid, history may well come to repeat itself. And yet nobody says a word about it. No one ever says, you know, this doesn't make sense. My dad used to tell me there were no mistakes in life, only lessons if we learn from what goes wrong. One of the things that my paper for the social contract starts out with is a quote. I want to read that quote to you this evening. When the situation was manageable, it was neglected. And now that it is thoroughly out of hand, we apply too late the remedies which then might have effected a cure. There is nothing new in the story. It is as old as the Sibylline books. It falls into that long, dismal catalog of the fruitlessness of experience and the confirmed unteachability of mankind. Want of foresight, unwillingness to act when action would be simple and effective, lack of clear thinking, confusion of counsel until the emergency comes, until self-preservation strikes its jarring gong, these are the features which constitute endless repetition of history. The author of those words, the guy who spoke those words, in fact, Sir Winston Churchill. Through his eloquent speech that he delivered before the House of Commons on May 2, 1935, he voiced his frustrations and consternation about missed opportunities and failures to learn from history as the storm clouds of war were gathering on the horizon. The famed playwright George Bernard Shaw also had an interesting statement, and his lament certainly parallels Churchill's, but his lament much shorter. He simply said, "We learned from history that we learned nothing from history." In my paper, I also made note of the fact that when our commandos, when the Navy SEALs raided the Bin Laden compound, they found a whole library. Contained in the library was a copy of the 9/11 Commission report. Contained in that library was an application for United States citizenship. Clearly, bin Laden, who at the time was still planning more attacks on America, was very concerned about the findings of the 9/11 Commission. You know what I'd like to know, folks? How many members of our Congress or the administration have bothered to read the 9/11 Commission report? How many advocates for comprehensive immigration reform have bothered to read the 9/11 Commission report? How many of them even understand the significance of that report? And then we get to the preface of the 9/11 Commission staff report on terrorist travel. I know I've read it before, but it bears repeating today. It is perhaps obvious to state that terrorists cannot plan and carry out attacks in the United States if they are unable to enter the country. Yet prior to September 11, while there were efforts to enhance border security, no agency of the U.S. government thought of border security as a tool in the counterterrorism arsenal. Indeed, even after 19 hijackers demonstrated the relative ease of obtaining a U.S. visa and gaining admission into the United States, border security still is not considered a cornerstone of national security policy. We believe, for reasons we discuss in the following pages, that it must be made one. Congress gave the commission the mandate to study, evaluate, and report on immigration, non-immigrant visas, and border security, as these areas relate to the events of 9/11. This staff report represents 14 months of such research. It is based on thousands of pages of documents that we reviewed from the State Department, the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the Central Intelligence Agency, the Department of Defense, approximately 25 briefings on various border security topics, and more than 200 interviews. We are grateful to all who assisted and supported us along the way. The story begins with a factual overview of the September 11th border story. This introduction summarizes many of the key facts of the hijackers' entry into the United States. In it, we endeavor to dispel the myth that their entry into the United States was clean and legal. It was not. Three hijackers carried passports with indicators of Islamic extremism linked to Al-Qaeda. Two others carried passports manipulated in a fraudulent manner. It is likely that several more hijackers carried passports with similar fraudulent manipulations. Two hijackers lied on their visa application, and once in the United States, two hijackers violated the terms of their admission. One overstayed his visa, and all but one obtained some form of state ID. We know that six of the hijackers used these state-issued IDs to check in for their flights on September 11th, and three of them were fraudulently obtained. How clear is that? The first agency that they reviewed the documents from, by the way, not the FBI, the Immigration and Naturalization Service. The bottom line, folks, we have an obligation to ourselves, to our families, our children, our grandchildren, those who will follow us, to make our elected representatives accountable. Make them represent us. Make them live up to their oaths of office. Make them defend the Constitution. And there should be consequences for those who don't. There is no doubt in my mind why Hillary Clinton said, "What difference does it make?" with such righteous indignation. Because we, the people, have come to educate our politicians and convince them that they could literally get away with murder. People have lost their lives because of the incompetence and corruption of our government. It has to stop, and only we can make that happen. Remember, folks, democracy is not a spectator sport. I look forward to joining you again next week, same time, right here on the Michael Cutler Hour. If you like the program, tell your friends and neighbors and become a part of my Bucket Brigade of Truth. Thank you so much, folks. See you next week. Have a terrific weekend. Be well.